from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The political future of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in question today after his party failed to win enough votes on Tuesday to build a governing coalition. We'll get the latest on Israel's deadlocked election. Then at 10:30, Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg will be joining us. He's head of the new statewide commission on homelessness and supportive housing. With President Trump blasting California for its handling of the homeless crisis, we'll talk with Steinberg about what the feds can do to help, and we'll hear about his right to shelter proposal aimed at getting people off the streets. That's next, right after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The political deadlock continues in Israel today after the country's second election this year. Official results are still unavailable, but it looks like neither Benjamin Netanyahu's conservative Likud party nor the centrist Blue and White party, led by former military chief of staff Benny Gantz, have won enough seats in parliament for a majority. As lawmakers begin negotiations to form a governing coalition, we're going to talk about the results and the likelihood of or possibility of a third election. And we also want to discuss a potential new coalition implication for Middle East peace and security. Paul Donaher joins us. He's the American Bureau Chief for the BBC, formerly BBC Bureau Chief in the Middle East. And welcome, Paul. Good to have you.
Thanks very much.
Let's begin by just updating. There seem to be at least a couple of options now, at least as one wag put it, King Bibi's crown has been removed, and it was pretty much perceived that Avigdor Lieberman, the leader of a much smaller party, would be the kingmaker here. But this, at this point, first of all, we have more votes to count, don't we? And we also have nobody with a clear majority, but we have all kinds of possibilities.
Yeah, we have as many possibilities as we have parties, really, at the moment. The problem for Netanyahu is he called this election because he couldn't do a deal with Avigdor Lieberman, because Lieberman didn't want to be in the same party as the ultra-Orthodox and the religious parties. So because he couldn't get a majority, he called an election. He expected to get more seats. That would mean he wouldn't need Lieberman. And that failed. And what that's done not only caused a lot of chaos in Israel, but it's also tarnished his reputation as this kind of magician when it comes to pulling rabbits out of the hat during Israeli elections. In many ways, Netanyahu's greatest achievement, perhaps only real achievement, is that he's managed to hang on for so long. He doesn't really have much of a legacy beyond lots of kind of records being broken on how long he's managed to hang on for. So all he wants to do is survive. I think the situation that he faces is that the only way there is going to be any kind of stable government is if he goes, because nobody seems to want to jump in bed with him anymore.
Well, in fact, he's been saying, let's have a unity government. And that did exist in Israel. Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin had a unity government. But this is something Benny Gantz has pretty much ruled out. He said, I'll work with Likud, but I'm not going to have Netanyahu. And a lot of that has to do with these charges that are up against that Netanyahu is up against, right?
Yeah, and the reason why it's important for Netanyahu to stay prime minister is it means that he's got immunity from those charges. And if he doesn't, then he's got a lower position in the political food chain. And that means he would have to resign, as actually Avigdor Lieberman had to do when he was in the government. And he also faced charges. So Netanyahu knows that there's more than just his political life hanging on this. His security and his protection from the law is hanging on this. And so, yes, of course, he's offering to sit down and negotiate, et cetera, but he's doing it from a position of huge weakness. Benny Gantz simply doesn't want to work with him. Avigdor Lieberman doesn't want to work with the religious parties that Netanyahu has signed up to. The only way you can make all the numbers work is if you do have a blue and white and a Likud and Avigdor Lieberman's party all together. And then, yes, you could hold the government together for as long as any government in Israel tends to hang together these days.
But doesn't the Israeli president, Reuven Rivlin, have a role in this, some potential?
Well, he does. He decides who he thinks has got more chance of pulling together a government. But again, no one's going to want to do anything if Netanyahu is at the top of this pile. Now, if Netanyahu wasn't facing these legal challenges, you could see a circumstance where he would say, OK, I'll take the back foot and I'll let them all make a mess of it and I'll make a comeback. But this is more complicated for him this time. He loses his immunity from charges. Now, obviously, we don't know whether he's guilty or innocent of these charges yet, but it does mean that if he is concerned about the way that that's going to go, he will fight to stay on as Prime Minister because it protects him. And that's what's changed things this time around. It's not just about his political future. It's whether or not he can stay out of jail.
He said the charges are, in fact, he used President Trump language, witch hunt, and President Trump was not exactly very supportive by many people's lights to Netanyahu when he saw that Netanyahu may have not created the coalition politically that he needed to stay in power. But I'm interested in something that has emerged from this election, and that is a kind of unity party getting together in terms of an Arab coalition or Arab voters. I mean, they are now the third. Well, they're now right now at a place in the Knesset where they have considerable more weight and leverage. And the fact of the matter is that they had been boycotting voting and they went out, and they went out in rather astonishing numbers.
They did, and they were goaded many times by Netanyahu. And then also he threatened, he did this last time around, he said, you know, the Arabs are coming, pretty much. Get out there and vote, otherwise they're going to take over the place. This time around, the Arabs did go out and vote. They voted this time around and not last time around, because this time around their representatives got together and formed what they've called the kind of joint list, whereas last time they were all over the place and everyone was voting in little groups and it didn't give them any real say in things. The problem you've got, though, is even if you add together the blue and white and the joint list and the kind of other left-wing parties, that still doesn't give them enough. So it requires Avigdor Lieberman's party, Israel Our Home, which is broadly speaking supported by the Russian-speaking community in Israel, to then join. But they won't join in any coalition that involves Arab parties. So that's where all these complicating things are. The big issue are the two smaller parties, the Arab list and it's the ultra-Orthodox parties. Because what's changed in Israel is a massive impatience towards the ultra-Orthodox community and the things they're allowed not to do, in particular serve within the army. Serving in the army is what every single kid does when they become a teenager. Girls and boys, they go off and it's part of, you know, in many ways, becoming an Israeli adult. And they, at the moment, are allowed not to do that. And that's caused a great deal of frustration and angst. It didn't matter at the beginning of the creation of Israel because the numbers of ultra-Orthodox Jews were still very small. Now they're a much larger part of the population. And people are saying now they need to make more of a contribution. Now they actually do need to sign up and get involved and be part of the army and do their national service. And Avigdor Lieberman left because he couldn't get an agreement that they would do that. The Blue and White Party, because they're more secular, are also against the idea of allowing him out of this. And the left-wing parties are too. So you've just got this kind of really difficult jigsaw. And it feels like people have kind of sawn different bits and different edges off of it. And it doesn't fit together anymore. And that's the big problem in Israel. There is no workable coalition, certainly not if Netanyahu has any senior role in it.
We're talking with Paul Danaher, and he is America Bureau Chief for the BBC. And we invite your calls. This is a half-hour segment, so if you have something you'd like to ask Paul or if you'd like to weigh in here and join the conversation, I would suggest that you call us now. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. Netanyahu era poised to end as Israel election results are almost final. And it's clear that there's no real Israeli left in this. You mentioned some left parties, but in terms of leverage and in terms of Knesset power, it's pretty much diminished.
It is. And the interesting thing about Netanyahu is, you know, he was, you know, 10, 15 years ago considered to be a right-wing hawk. Now, he hasn't really changed, but Israel has moved to the right around him. So he's now kind of not quite a moderate, but in terms of the Israeli political spectrum, he's no longer out on the far right of it. Israel has moved to the right. It's moved to the right for a number of reasons. It's moved because there's been a massive growth in the kind of religious nationalist movement. Those people that were a minority originally, they were kind of part of the settler movement, and they've become more and more vocal and more strong in the political spectrum. You've had an increase in the ultra-Orthodox parties, and you've also seen a move away and almost a kind of death of those campaigning for a peace deal with the Palestinians. And I think what really kind of kicked that into touch was the Arab Spring, when the Arab world too lost interest pretty much in the Palestinian cause because they had so much else going on at home. And so you've seen what used to happen in the past was Israel and Israeli politicians had to make the right noises about the peace process, even if they didn't really believe them. After the Arab Spring, they could stop doing even that. And that has meant that basically it's been more acceptable to be more right-wing, and that has encouraged more and more right-wing politicians and parties to make their play, and they've become stronger.
But Gantz has called for actually pursuing peace with the Palestinians, has he not?
He has, but he's also, it's quite hardline. I mean, he's not going to, he's going to probably want to hang on to the Jordan Valley in some way for security. He's not going to pull out all the settlements. He may be a bit kind of tougher when it comes to the illegal outposts, those that both the Israeli state and the Palestinians say are illegal. But, you know, he's not a left winger. I mean, as I say, he would have been a right winger 10, 15 years ago. It's because Israel's moved so much to the right that now we consider him to be a moderate. He's a moderate in 2019. He wouldn't have been seen as one in 2001, for example.
Again, we invite you to join us with any thoughts or questions you might have for our guest, Paul Donahoe, who is American Bureau Chief for the BBC. And he was based in Jerusalem as Middle East Bureau Chief from 2010 to 2013. He's also the author of New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. And if you want to be part of the program, the number to call is 866-733-6786, or you can get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. And a question from Richard Paul, who says, can Netanyahu now be prosecuted for corruption, or is his continuing position still giving him immunity? And I think the question you answered it before is he can indeed be prosecuted, and maybe.
He can. And the thing is, that at the moment, while he's prime minister, he can't. When he stops being prime minister, he will have to resign his position as a lower minister and face these charges, as Avigdor Lieberman had to do. Now, he was cleared of them and he came back into politics, and he's now doing very well for himself. So, yes, he's very, very vulnerable. And he's never been in this situation before. He's always been, he was prime minister before. He got booted out. He came back again. He's been a phenomenally successful politician, but he's only been successful when he's been managing the politics. Now he's got to manage the criminal courts and the legal system, and that's something that he can't control. That's something he can't use fear and favor to get around. And so he's very, very vulnerable.
We should mention he's facing charges for bribery and fraud and break of trust. And I'm wondering if you think there's a possibility for a third election to be called.
I think the Israelis are sick of going to the polls, but that may be no other way around. I suspect probably not. I think eventually Netanyahu will be pushed aside, and Benny Gantz will hold out until he can be clear of that, because Avigdor Lieberman doesn't want Netanyahu, and Benny Gantz doesn't want Netanyahu. And I think increasingly people now are seeing beyond the Netanyahu era. He's managed to hang on for a very, very long time. He's controlled Israeli politics pretty much single-handedly. And I think people now think that, it's a matter of time and they'll just allow things to drag on. I mean, people are not going to be in a great hurry to resolve this until eventually he steps aside. I just cannot see how he can lead another government. And I can't see how he can stay in any government while he faces these legal challenges. And so I think it will be a slow sunset. But I do think we are seeing the sunset on Prime Minister Netanyahu, or Benjamin Netanyahu, for the time being.
And how does the sunset affect what we're in now, which is a very volatile situation with Iran and escalating tensions? I mean, it certainly can affect the whole Middle East because Saudi Arabia and Iran have become enemies. And certainly under Netanyahu, there was constant talk about the existential threat to Israel of Iran, and very bellicose talk from both sides, of course. But Benjamin Netanyahu came here, talked before the United States Congress in terms of, not being a part of the treaty, which Trump followed through on. And Trump is very popular in Israel. And I'm just wondering how you see the ongoing relationship with Israel and the United States, but also under Gantz, if he's indeed the leader, or with respect to Iran.
I think there's a number of things there. I think what this election result has done is made the possibility of immediate military action against Iran move away, because Israel has to absorb any of the outcome of that. fallout of that. And I don't think you can really say you've got Israel on board when you don't really know who the prime minister is going to be. So I think the immediate effect is it does make conflict with Iran less likely. Now, if you look at Netanyahu, he's always used Iran as his big, I will save Israel from Iran. He's never really been that interested in doing a peace deal with the Palestinians. He's never really seen his place in history to be the man that brought peace to the Middle East, or rather to end the Israel-Palestine conflict. Iran has been the thing that he's kind of built his the idea of himself around, because he's built himself as the only man that can protect Israel from those crazy people in Iran. I think if he goes, then I don't think that Benny Gantz will be any softer on Iran. But what I don't think he will do is feel that Iran is the issue that he's got to tie himself to. I think he will be more pragmatic with regard to Iran. I don't think he'll be talking up the kind of existential threat language that Netanyahu does. I think there's more chance of a pragmatic approach towards the Palestinians. I don't think it'll be easy for them, but I do think it'll be more pragmatic. And I also think what will change is the way that Israel deals with the rest of the world. The thing about Netanyahu was he kind of thought he had America worked out. He feels that he knows which buttons to press and how to play to the gallery and how to pretty much win over public and political support in America. And because he did that, he pretty much ignored the Europeans and ignored the EU and made himself very unpopular there. I think Benny Gantz, if he does take over, will reset things. He will be realistic about support in America. I think he will be more realistic about the need for support in Europe. And I think if he starts kind of reaching out to people and tries to get a broader coalition, if you like, from the West towards moving forward with Israel, with the Palestinians, he'll also, I think, he's in a situation where there is a broader acceptance from the Arab world that something needs to be done. And the Palestinians will still be in the weakest position that they've ever been. And it does make the possibility that compromise can be found, I think, more likely than it has been. I don't think Netanyahu really was that fussed about whether he got a peace deal on his watch. I don't think it will be Benny Gantz's top priority, but I do think it's a much more realistic prospect that you could see some movement forward in the peace process if Netanyahu goes.
I'm looking at a comment, rather strong comment, to put it mildly, from Ali, who says the only difference between the two candidates for prime minister is how many Palestinians they believe is acceptable to kill. But the reality is, during the campaign, we were hearing Benny Gantz certainly trying to bring out the Arab vote by talking on the Palestinian vote, those who are living in Israel and are citizens and can vote. He was talking about, giving housing and talking about less interference from police or less brutality from police, those kinds of issues that affect the Palestinian and Arab communities.
Absolutely. And I think the thing you need to recognize, I think people need to recognize, broadly speaking, is Arab Israelis are different and have had a different experience than Palestinians living on the West Bank. They are, many of them broadly accept that they are Israelis, and which is why they became so angry when this legislation went through that defined Israel as a Jewish state.
Under Netanyahu, of course.
Yeah, rather than as the state of the Jewish people. They had no problem with saying Israel is the state of the Jewish people. They recognized that. But they were against the idea of it being declared a Jewish state, because as far as they were concerned, hang on, where do we fit into a Jewish state? You're basically saying we're not part of this. So there was the Arab Israelis are part of Israel. They have a very different history and experience than the rest of the Arab world. And they wanted to feel represented. They wanted to have a say. And you're right, Benny Gantz reached out. And whereas Netanyahu saw them as a stick to try and beat the Israeli right with, Benny Gantz looked the other way and said, no, hang on, we can probably kind of not have them fight against us. And I think, that attitude probably won him one or two seats, not a massive amount, but it probably meant that he got that kind of extra little kick that enabled him to get more, probably only one or two seats more than Likud. And by doing so, basically take away Netanyahu's right to claim to be prime minister again.
Well, what was the Arab vote turnout? It was pretty much determined. It was higher than it had ever been.
It went up, it went up 10%. I mean, that's quite a big jump. And I think the thing is that it went down last time, as I say, because they weren't They didn't get their act together, the Arab parties. But there was if you look at the way the Arab vote works in Israel, it kind of goes up and down, depending on whether they think anybody's listening to them or whether or not they think they're actually going to be able to change things. So when there is an election going on and people are giving the impression that the Arab vote is important, and therefore the Arab leaders can go out there and say, look, we can actually make a difference in time, you can get them out there. If the Arab parties are squabbling amongst themselves, then the Arab voters just stay at home. So I think Netanyahu, because in April he made such a big deal and used them and did this kind of real, you know, my God, we've got to get out there and stop the Arabs voting. This was kind of a response to that. It was kind of, you know what, we are going to go out and vote this time and we are going to get rid of you because we are pretty sick of what's going on. And some of the things he's done recently, in the way that he's become much more hardline and much more aligned himself to the politics of the settler movement, has basically made Arabs think, well, you know, we've got nothing to lose. In fact, we've got a lot to lose if we don't go out. So let's go out and vote. And I think them coming out and voting, that extra 10% actually is what tipped things the other way. And they will be seen as having quite a big impact on this election. Now, that will be used against them by some of the right wing parties in Israel, which is why I think it will be difficult for blue and white to form a coalition with the Arab parties inside. Because otherwise they'll be open to kind of, being illegitimate in the eyes of many right-wing Israelis.
Well, there was all this talk about voter fraud from Netanyahu. There were even video cameras in the voting places to try to show perhaps that there was some kind of voter fraud. But this 10% jump is really quite significant, as you're indicating, not only in terms of the determining what happened in the election, but also it could become an opportunity for the head of the Arab Voting Coalition to not only have access to security briefings, but a platform to speak from.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think in many ways, I mean, as I say, the Arab Israelis are different from you know, the Arabs on Arab Palestinians on the West Bank. You know, they are part of Israel, and they've been demonized by the right wing in Israel as a kind of fifth column. But they're not. They are as Israeli as anybody else. I mean, their families have been there for years. They've stayed. They're part of the society. They're part of the community. They've often felt they are sidelined and ostracized often from many aspects of Israeli life. But I think, you know, if you want to basically reach some kind of settlement within Israel and settlement with the Palestinians, then they're important. And I think what we've got now is basically a reset, as I said earlier, where people are going to have to look and say, look, we're faced with this reality. And once Netanyahu's out the picture, as I think eventually he will be, it will basically allow Likud to start reinventing itself, because Netanyahu has basically smothered the party. No one's been able to do anything without him. And I think that will open things up. But it may mean that we move towards a situation where you don't have everyone against Netanyahu. You might actually start getting bigger parties being formed, because it's not about Netanyahu anymore. This election was about Netanyahu. When he's out of the picture, it might start moving back to policy again.
Let me read a quick comment from a listener who says, I don't know too much about Israeli politics. I'm not a big fan of the settlements, but my impression is that Netanyahu presided over a generally peaceful and prosperous period for Israel. For example, he's continued to thwart Hamas attacks and tunnels from Gaza and kept Hezbollah in check, too. That's not nothing.
Well, what he's been unquestionably quite tough. But if you think about it, Benny Gantz was the man that was doing a lot of that for him, because he was the chief of staff until quite recently. So both men can make a claim that they've kept Israel safe. I think what's changed, as I say, after the
Arab Spring. Paul, forgive me. I'm going to have to conclude this. We're coming up on a break. And I appreciate very much your being with us. Paul Donahue, again, is American Bureau Chief for the BBC. His book is called The World After the Arab Spring. It's called The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. When we return, we're going to talk with the mayor of Sacramento, Daryl Steinberg, all about homelessness. Stay tuned. That's right up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny. Here's what's coming up tomorrow on Forum with guest host Scott Schaefer. Author Malcolm Gladwell will be joining us to discuss his new book, Talking with Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. Then National Book Award and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Colson Whitehead will join the program in studio to discuss segregation in the civil rights era, which formed the backdrop for his new novel, The Nickel Boys. To listen to past shows and join the discussion, visit kqed.org/forum and for the latest updates on our programs and guests, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. While visiting California this week, President Trump decried the homelessness crisis in cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco.
If you look at San Francisco, it's a total disaster. What's happening? Are they going to ruin those cities? And we're going to get involved very soon on a federal basis if they don't clean up their act.
As yet, the president has offered few solutions, suggesting that deregulation would increase housing supply. And yesterday, the Trump administration declined the state's request for 500,000 more federal housing vouchers. We're joined now by Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg, the head of the state's new Commission on Homelessness and Supportive Housing, to talk about the homelessness crisis. And welcome, Daryl Steinberg.
Thank you for having me again, Michael.
Always glad to have you. And we're talking about some pretty serious stuff here, though, particularly in light of your new role, and I want to talk about that as well. But let's begin by talking about Ben Carson's visit here before we get to President Trump, because he was talking, I think it may be better expressed by Sarah Short, who is with the Coalition on Homelessness. There was a good deal of talk about public housing and touting that sort of thing while cuts are going on, big cuts.
Well, I guess it's not surprising, but the last thing we need from the federal government is to politicize a very serious issue. And whether it's Secretary Carson or President Trump, it's so clear from the president that he is looking for another one of those so-called wedge issues to play to his base in the Midwest. I mean, we've seen the script so many times now. This is a very serious issue where we could actually use the active partnership of the federal government if they were so inclined. And the governor's requests for 50,000 additional housing vouchers, where we know we have a huge shortage, there's long waiting lists in every city, would be a tangible and demonstrable help to actually getting people indoors. And so he came, he went, and I'm sure he'll move on to the next set of issues. But we just have to lead ourselves here and be committed to getting tens of thousands of people under a roof so that they can begin to regain their health and their lives and at the same time provide relief on our streets.
But Housing and Urban Development has actually put out new regulations that could turn thousands out of public housing, and that includes 55,000 children.
No question about it. I mean, in fact, the federal government, because of the Trump administration, because of the anti-immigrant screed, is potentially going to make the problem much worse. That's exactly right. And so I think we can fight as we must always and resist. But at the same time, we cannot be distracted for the long term with those games. And they're very serious. They're not games. They're very serious issues, of course, with what Trump and the federal government want to do. But we have to lead and we have to have our own North Star. And I define our North Star as getting 90,000 unsheltered homeless people under a roof so that they can better be served and, maybe as importantly, having a clear, robust strategy to prevent people who are fragile and housed from becoming fragile and unsheltered and homeless. And these are big tasks, but we have a unique opportunity with a new governor who cares about these sets of issues deeply. And I'm optimistic and ready for the fight.
We're talking with Mayor Daryl Steinberg, and he is mayor of Sacramento, and we're talking about homelessness. His proposal, his right to shelter proposal, is aimed at people off the streets. And I want to talk about that with you, Mayor Steinberg. But first, I'm just wondering about what your response was to this Monday report that was released from the Council of Economic Advisers. It's a 40-page report, and it really does single out California in a number of ways. It says that four of five U.S. cities with the highest rates of homelessness are here in California. And in fact, when Ben Carson, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, was here, he kept pointing out that there are too many regulations in California. Arizona and Florida have nice climates, but they don't have anything even representing similar to our homelessness problem. And I'm just wondering about those kind of arguments that, in other words, as I deconstruct them, what they really seem to be saying is these liberals are failing.
Of course, that's what they're saying, because that's the political frame. And again, the last thing we need is to politicize these sets of issues. You don't have to tell us that in California, we have a significant housing production and volume challenge, and that there are some regulations that should be looked at. Of course, we know that. But it's a lot more than that. And I think the argument gets grossly oversimplified. We've got a growing state, a large state, and we have a housing challenge. We don't need Trump and the federal government to tell us that. What we really need is tangible partnership, not help, but tangible partnership where they help us increase our housing production by being more aggressive, for example, about these housing choice vouchers and many other strategies.
Let me just ask you, though, if I may, sorry to interrupt, but I'm just wondering what you, again, I was struck by that report that was put out because they're talking about cutting San Francisco's homeless population in half by making the city's building codes more like those, for example, in Arizona. And they also say Los Angeles could do that about 40% more. In other words, if we're more development friendly.
First of all, we don't want to be Arizona or Texas. We're California. And, you know, some regulation is very important. Some regulation protects the safety of workers. Some regulation protects and stands up for genuine environmental concerns and issues. Some regulations actually have us in the lead when it comes to climate change, not only in the country, in the world. And so it's an overbroad argument. And there's no proof that making the generalized changes that this report talks about would lead to 40% reduction in homelessness. Where do they get that kind of thing? It's just not true.
Let me go to your proposals, because I think it's important that the public is aware of what you're trying to do here. You're talking about housing as a human right, which certainly many have done, particularly in this area, but also saying that we need to have it as a legal right. And this comes under the rubric of right to shelter, an obligation, actually, to accept shelter. And also, you've been bringing some attention to the idea that it being out on the street and sleeping on the street shouldn't be considered a civil right.
I have said all those things because it's exactly what I believe. And let's step back because it's a nuanced and difficult issue, but I want to try to explain it. New York City, has a right to shelter. 95% of their homeless population is under a roof. Only 5% are unsheltered. Now, we don't want to replicate the New York model because, frankly, they have not added and combined the intensive mental health and drug treatment services, and they haven't been aggressive enough about moving people through their shelter system into longer-term housing. But the right, they state, is nonetheless very, very powerful. And I think we have to acknowledge in this society and in this state specifically that we have a tacit public policy that says it's okay for people to live outdoors. And living outdoors is unsafe, it is unhealthy, and it is frankly uncivil. And so what is the state's role? Certainly it is to help provide resources and funding and partnership with local government to provide the array of strategies and services that are necessary to help people. But we first start with stating and being clear about the public policy. The public policy in this state should be and must be that people live indoors. And that can be both a right and an obligation. And until we set that imperative as our North Star, we are going to do a lot of good along the way, but we're not going to actually show the relief and the progress that I think people expect us to stay and to achieve. And so I say a right to a roof over your head is the beginning, not the end, because you have to combine the services and continue to focus on permanent supportive housing. But shelter is no longer the stereotypical dingy long-term shelter that people conjure up when they think about shelter. The new shelter are these short-term navigation centers, rehousing centers, where you bring people in to help them get stable and to help them figure out what might be next. Shorter term, intensive services. Here's the bottom line. Not only is a policy that people can live outdoors unsafe and unhealthy, but the people themselves can't be helped until they're under a roof. And so this is a very complicated issue. And what I'm calling for is to, at least at the beginning, simplify what our imperative and what our goal should be. And I think that's the state of California establishing a public policy that clearly says it's not okay to live outdoors.
Let me hear from you. Our listeners are talking to Daryl Steinberg, and get some reaction from you who are listening and thoughts, questions for the mayor of Sacramento, who is now co-chair of the Commission on Homelessness and Supportive Housing. You can join us right now and give us a call at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786. Or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email any questions you might have for the mayor to forum@kqed.org. We should mention, by the way, the model of New York came under a consent decree, Callahan versus Kerry. But I was also struck by the fact that you have said we don't have the housing stock. And also, when you're talking about people on the streets, what comes to my mind, again, is something that the Trump administration has been hammering and that Ben Carson was hammering, and that is there's not enough law enforcement. And I'd like you to address that, if you could, before we bring our callers on.
Well, sure. Look, at permanent housing with the supportive services is absolutely the goal, and we should not lose our focus there. But the Bay Area Council produced a very provocative and in some way damning report back in the spring, in which they said in the Bay Area itself, it would take until 2037 to build enough permanent supportive housing units to permanently house all the currently homeless people in the Bay Area. And that certainly begs the question, what do we do in the meantime? How do we bring people indoors so that they have an actual chance to get to permanent housing? Now, there are some people, the reason I call it a right to a roof over your head as opposed now to a right to shelter is because some people might be ready for permanent housing that might be available, but people need to be indoors. On the law enforcement piece, this one is interesting. The cities and many are upset and worried about the so-called Boise decision, which essentially says that law enforcement cannot break up tent encampments unless and until you can offer the person who's camping out an actual bed under a roof. And I oppose, frankly, seeking to overturn it, and maybe I'm in the minority among city mayors there, because I think it actually provides the incentive to do what we have to do, which is to build more beds and create more beds. And as long as we have the ability to offer somebody an indoor bed, hopefully permanent housing, but at least quality shelter with the services, once we can make that offer, then I'm absolutely fine with enforcement, because I don't think that, again, living on the street, one, is a civil right, and two, Boise and the laws do not prevent law enforcement from enforcing clearly illegal behavior now and antisocial behavior. If somebody's selling drugs, if somebody is engaging in behavior that obstructs others, that can be dealt with and should be dealt with under any circumstances.
Let me go to our callers, and we go to you, Mark, first. You're on the air. Morning.
Thanks. Good morning. I agree with the mayor, and I have this conversation with my friends all the time. I live in the Bay Area. I drive around. There's not one day that goes by that I don't see an encampment and wonder why we're allowing, as a society, people to live in that manner. And it always comes down to, in my mind anyway, that most of these people that I see don't want to be in a shelter. They're mentally ill. They're on drugs. They like the freedom that they have. And the only way you'll be able to provide them this temporary shelter is to hold them against their will. And without being able to do that, there's never going to be any progress. Well, how do you address that?
Yeah, it's the whole problem with conservatorships. I'd like to hear, Mayor Steinberg, what you have to say.
Sure. So I understand the point that the speaker makes, and there's always some truth in any statement like that, but I think it's overstated respectfully, because here's what we know. that if we engage in what we call assertive outreach and really are proactive about interacting with people on the streets, and we're focused on the volume of people and getting people indoors, the majority of people will in fact come inside. Treatment resistance is fear. It's people who are living with a serious mental illness and or drug addicted, and that effort at trying to build trust and relationship will get most people inside. Now, there are some people who will not come inside, and in that regard, my view, again, is that once we create the right to a roof over your head and we actually have the capacity, we then have the moral high ground and maybe even the legal ground to say, you have to come indoors.
Let me thank Mark for his call. We're going to go right to another caller, and that's you, Peter, joining us from Palo Alto. Welcome.
Thank you very much. So having spent years working with the homeless population, running my own nonprofit, providing hygiene at the street level, and in various other capacities, I can tell you that, as a matter of fact, shelters are not the full answer. And the reason for that is that most shelters are as on a basis of first come, first serve, or lottery. There's not enough shelter space for everyone. People are not allowed to bring in much of their belongings. And then at the end of the night, you're kicked out back onto the street. And it's this daytime street presence that is the biggest problem for local businesses and residents primarily. Local navigation centers that provide day services, including basic hygiene, showers, laundry facilities, access to ability to get ID, to get medical services, mental health, drug treatment, alcohol treatment, help getting work and finding housing, is just as important as sheltering people at night. And until cities are willing to do that and do it in a decentralized way, neighborhood by neighborhood, the problem is never going to be solved.
You say what, Mayor Steinberg, to Peter's remarks?
Yeah, I think that Peter is describing the old definition of shelter. That's not what we mean by shelter. And I understand terminology is important. And, you know, the word shelter conjures up a lot of meanings for people. First of all, we are talking about shelters that meet people where they are. We call them the three P's: pets, possessions, and partners, where people come in without having to give up that which provides some security for them on the streets. Secondly, we're talking about 24/7 shelters. We're not talking about telling people to leave when the sun rises in the morning. Third, we're talking about temporary navigation centers and combining intensive case management and intensive services so that people can get stable and then have an opportunity to move on to longer term or permanent settings. Without that bridge, so many people, especially the chronically homeless, are not ready for permanent housing. And of course, we don't have enough permanent housing stock at this point to be able to actually get people under a roof. And so I want to emphasize again, shelter is not the end. The right to a roof over your head could be shelter. It could be transitional housing. It can be permanent housing. But it is the principle and the public policy that we must bring people indoors. It's the only chance they have at a better life and life. And the only chance we have to show the public rightfully that we are making a real progress on something that is just plain unacceptable in civil society.
I want to thank Peter for his call, and I want to bring on another caller, and that's Erlinda. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to respond to the guy who said that most of the people are mentally ill or, and substance abusers. You know, we've got seniors on the streets and other low-income people who simply cannot get back into housing. They lost their current housing for whatever reason, and it's just unaffordable. I'm thinking particularly of a senior that I know who lives out of her truck, and for 5 years, she's on a waiting list for 5 years for housing. She can't afford what is currently on her Social Security disability. She can't afford.
I think with all the displacement we're seeing, this is a very important and crucial point. And Mayor Steinberg, I'm looking at a comment, in fact, phrases a question from Larry that dovetails with what we just heard from Arlinda. He says, what's being done or could be done to prevent homelessness, like in the case when a senior has to stop working and lives exclusively on Social Security?
Well, many things. I mean, certainly prevention, as I talked about earlier, is every bit as important, if not more important, than what we're doing to get homeless people off the streets. Because, of course, what we're finding is we're permanently housing a lot of people in California, but the problem grows worse because the people housed are then replaced by a new cohort of newly homeless people. And you're right, the statistics show a lot of seniors, a lot of people over 50 years old, and talk about unacceptable in terms of our morality and how we care for elderly people, that they would be out on the street. So a couple things. Number one, we need more interventions. We need the ability to, in a very flexible way, provide the $1,000 to the person or family that, because of a broken down car, a lost job, a changed circumstance, an unreasonable rent increase, although that now is going to be better, I think, as a result of the David Chu bill signed by the governor, the rent stabilization bill, to be able to help prevent somebody from becoming homeless. Chicago did this, and the studies found that people who got that in-the-moment intervention with the right kind of accountability increased their tenancies by up to 24 months. And so we've got to prevent people from becoming homeless in the first place. But the other thing I want to mention, dovetailing off the question, is that we have to create a market in California for more efficiency housing, because affordable subsidized housing in California requires a subsidy of between $400,000 and $700,000 per unit. And the folks who build this, by the way, are heroic. They do great work. But we are never going to get to the volume if we don't create a market for 200, 300 square foot homes with roof, plumbing, electricity, security, and dignity. And so some of our housing, public housing money from both the state and local government must be purposefully directed towards subsidies that require, say, $100,000 or less per unit, so that we're actually creating a market for more efficiency housing. That will help a lot, too.
And let me remind you, we're talking to Mayor Daryl Steinberg about homelessness, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me bring another caller aboard here. We go to you next. Jake, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on the study you brought up earlier regarding the building codes in Arizona and Florida developing cheaper houses. I don't think it's really appropriate to say that we should, match ourselves to their building codes when a lot of their building codes are based in the fact that they have less seismic activity. As everybody knows, we've got plenty of earthquakes here in California, and on top of that, our major metropolitan areas are in very poor soil areas. So our building is naturally expensive just from the fact of what we have to put it on. So to eliminate some of those regulations would be not frivolous regulations, but rather life and safety regulations. So I don't think we should be creating a new second class of housing for low-income people by eliminating some of the very important regulations that save us from things like a collapse and an earthquake or a fire spreading throughout the home.
Important point, Jake, and I thank you for it and appreciate hearing from you. Let me go back to another dimension of this coming from the federal government, Daryl Steinberg. You know, there's now a threat from the president of bringing in the EPA and talk from him about needles going into the ocean, which is absurd talk, of course, but Mayor Breed has responded very, I think, fully on that. I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Absurd and, You hope that there's a 1% chance that when the president of the United States talks about homelessness, that it might be constructive and there might be some help. But you know with this president that it's 99% that it's going to be a political show. And, of course, sometimes you hit the 1 in 100, but this case, the 99 is coming through loud and clear because he's not serious about it. You know that there won't be any sustained follow-up to anything that he wants to do.
Well, he's even talking about going to L.A. to the encampments, and I haven't seen any activity there. I mean, it's a good example.
Right. I just hope that he doesn't come back to California for a while. How about that?
Let me read a tweet. This is from Nance, who writes, "People seem to have forgotten that we've had a series of wildfires that have left people homeless. I live in the Santa Rosa area and see more tent cities now than before the fires." And Robert asks, "Should the big tech companies that bring thousands of employees to the area be required to help pay for housing the homeless, especially since they are major contributors to the affordable housing crisis?" Daryl Steinberg.
Well, we sure could use the help of the private sector in big ways. But, you know, there are those. Mark Benioff has stepped up big time in San Francisco. And, of course, in the Silicon Valley, I know that they have put together a very robust housing trust. But I think the broader point is absolutely correct. This requires a real partnership here. It's got to be the federal government, maybe with a different president. It's the state government leading, especially around establishing that public policy I talked about earlier, that everybody lives under a roof. The local governments have a big responsibility, obviously. And then it's the community and the private sector. This does take enormous resources to help people gain stability and to reduce the number of people on the street. And so, yes, we need more of everything from every sector of the state.
Let me try to get another quick caller in here. Margaret, that's you. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for this program. My son will be 50 in a couple of months. This has been 40 years of schizophrenia and hell for him and me both. I'm the one person in contact with him. Last, he was homeless for three years in San Rafael. And last year, a new program came where they did have wraparound services. They couldn't bring him off the street, but they saw him. He had great social workers who saw him twice a week and cared about him. And they came and met me at my house. They came up here to Santa Rosa. And eventually, he was conserved about 7 months ago. He's off meth. I'm happy and sorry to say.
Well, I'm sorry to say I'm going to have to cut you off there, but you got your story told, and it's a good story to end on here because it's a positive one. Daryl Steinberg, seconds left.
Very quick. Mental health is key here. You know, I authored Prop 63, the Mental Health Service Act. It's an essential piece of the puzzle here. We can do so much better in California, and we will.
Thank you, Mayor Steinberg. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you all for being with us this morning on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.